Good to see you, Tim. Good morning. Good morning, Exchange. How's everyone doing this morning? This is a special gift for me to be here with you all this morning. As Brian said, my wife Abby and I, we have been attending Exchange going on about 9 years now. We have three little rugrats you see running around with us. If you have met Julia Hope, you have likely gotten one of her patented hugs that melts your heart. If you've met Liam Wesley, you have met the sweetest, kindest, oldest soul in a five-year-old. And Jacob James, he runs around with the two-year-olds. We affectionately refer to him as our tornado. He is wild. And so we love being a part of the family of Exchange. We are originally from the Central Florida area. I am. My wife is from the South Florida area in Tampa. We moved up here in 2016. And when we moved up here, we actually had a couple of connections to Exchange. We had a couple of people that we knew from Florida that were either attending Exchange or had attended Exchange, not the least of which, I want to show you some pictures from the archive that you might recognize a familiar face here. We'll throw that first one on stage here. This goofy-looking kid sitting up in the back would be about ninth grade Josh, and right here in this fuzzy picture, you might recognize the TJ Copel. I wish they were here this week. I thought they were going to be. I did not tell them I was doing this. This is kind of a forgiveness permission kind of thing. So this is TJ. You may not know TJ and Krista and I. We grew up together in Florida. We went through youth group together. We'll show the next picture here. As you can see, TJ has been blessing people with his musical gifts for many, many years. And like any good friend, I was just trying to chase some clout by going on stage and shaking his hand after he did that. So right here, the next picture, this will be the last one I show. You'll see high school Krista kneeling down there in the front. This was about a month before I left for college. They were rising into their senior year there. These are our dear friends of ours. And I show these pictures to you because, well, any excuse to show these pictures. And also because these pictures for me tell a story. Now, these pictures tell a singular story, one that's just a moment in time, right? It's just a moment where I recall ninth grade and then probably 11th grade and here right before college. But they tell a bigger story than that for both Abby and myself. You see, I look at that first picture and I remember being in high school. I remember what the uncertainty was, not really sure what the Lord was doing. What's the Lord teaching me here in this moment? Where's he taking me? And the people that I see in those pictures are reminders of faces and voices that he used to encourage me in my walk with him. You fast forward about 10 years, and I found myself in a familiar feeling to early high school Josh. Abby and I had been married about 2 years, and we were about to leave the only state we had ever known. Most of our friends, all of our family down in Florida. And once again, navigating feelings of uncertainty, what's the Lord doing? Where are we going to plant our feet? And wouldn't you know it, about 20 yards door to door lived two familiar faces. Two faces that the Lord had used a decade prior to encourage me in my walk with him, once again found themselves in the day-to-day of our lives. Not only for the four of us as husbands and wives, but also for our kids. And I share that story with you because I think it's easy in those moments for us to see that as happenstance, right? This is, yeah, sure, Josh, you came up to seminary. TJ's in seminary, not a ton of seminary housing. It's pretty cool you ended up right across a grass courtyard together. But see, when I remember that story is not simply happenstance. That story is a testament to the grace of God in my life. It's a testament to the grace of God and his faithfulness for both Abby and myself. And I share that with you this morning because how we remember matters. How we remember matters because it shapes the stories that we tell. When we remember the faithfulness of God, it shapes the stories that we tell of our lives, which ultimately help us to fight to find perspective. If you got to hear Brian's sermon last week, I told him earlier this week, that I feel like we're preaching one sermon together. It's almost a part one, part two, where Asaph writes last week in 77 this psalm of lament, right? It's this psalm where he's speaking to what Brian referred to as the dark night of the soul. I'm walking through life. I'm doing the things. I'm living according to how he's called me to live. And yet I don't see the impact of God's hand in my circumstance. I don't feel the impact here in my emotions. And at the end of his sermon, Brian encouraged us toward two things. He encouraged us to fight to find thanksgiving and to fight to find perspective. And this final one's the one that really resonated with me this week as I was preparing for this morning, this fight to find perspective, because our perspective on life is often shaped by what we remember and the stories we tell. We know that there's great power in story. Perhaps you, like me, grew up and you heard stories in your life. There's often these fables we tell that have these moral implications, right? The tortoise and the hare, the slow and steady win the race. The boy who cried wolf. Julie and I actually just did this one very recently, right? When we tell falsehoods, when we pretend, we potentially break the trust of those around us here. The little engine that could, right? Perseverance and an optimistic heart can help you overcome adversity. We even see that Jesus did this same thing in the life of his ministry. He told these parables that helped to shape the perspective of those who were under his teaching. The prodigal son, right? The good Samaritan. Even Daniel read of one here, of the wise man and the foolish man who both chose which foundation on which to build their home. There's something powerful about the art of story that shapes our perspective. It can provide a picture of reality by which we live. And here this morning, we read of a psalm of Asaph where he knows this very truth. He knows this truth, but he's not just telling a simple fable. He is telling a story that is their story. He's going to tell them the story of their ancestors, of their fathers, of the way that God was faithful in and through their lives. And by doing so, he hopes to help them fight for perspective. So if you will join me in Psalm chapter 78, this is where we're going to begin this morning. And if you've already jumped there through the Church Center app, you have noticed that Asaph spares few details in this psalm. So we are going to buckle up and get after it. In verse 1 here of Psalm chapter 78, we read, "Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old, things that we have heard and known that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, but tell them to the coming generation, the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done." I love this start to this psalm. Here in these first 8 verses, Asaph's actually starting with this introduction. And as he kicks off this story, it felt similar to when I was growing up and you'd be walking through the house and you hear a grandparent or a parent say, hey, come here. I want to tell you a story. And often for me, that story was one that I had never heard before. It was something perhaps from their life. Perhaps it was one of those fables that we even just talked about a minute ago. But this time, Asaph is actually going to share with them a story that they know very well. This is a story that they have heard time and time and time again. And if you have the opportunity, as Brian said, I get to work with teenagers often, day to day. I also get to go home, like I said, to 3 tiny children. You know the response to a story that you have heard time and time again, right? It's this big shoulder shrug, the eye roll, the yeah, I know. I remember this story. I remember the point of it. God is faithful. I got it. And I think Asaph knows this. I think he knows the tendency for us to remember and recall the stories of our life and just jump to the end, to jump to the point, to jump to kind of like I did before, right? The slow and steady win the race. Yep, I've compartmentalized this into this place right here. But he wouldn't do that because he knew this for the people under his teaching, under his reading here. And he knows this for us today. Our first point this morning, recalling the story of God's faithfulness in our lives roots our hearts and our minds in truth. You see, Asaph knew this tendency for us to hear the truth and just know it up here, to just know it in our minds. What he wanted is not simply for us to just recall information, but to allow the truth of that information to take root, to embed itself into our heart, because he knows that when it does, it shapes the perspective and ultimately how we live. We read of the people of God as they're walking through Exodus and in the Old Testament here, and we see these seeds of doubt. We see these seeds of doubt that the enemy places in their lives, that even though they had just witnessed God's faithfulness, they still begin to doubt that God can truly provide. And we remember this even in the beginning of the word. Genesis chapter 3, we recall the story of Adam and Eve here, and the serpent speaking to Eve, and he says, he was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman this, he said, did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? It wasn't a full-on assault of her mind. It wasn't a full-on, no, it's not true. It was just this simple seed of doubt. Did God actually say? This was his tactic from the very beginning. This is his tactic even for us today. Because how easy it is for us to begin to allow those seeds of doubt to embed in our hearts that begin to block out the truth that we know. And so Asaph continues on in verse 5, and he says, he, meaning God, established a testimony in Jacob. He appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers to teach to their children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and arise to tell them to their children, so that they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and that they should not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit was not faithful to God. This is the command from the Lord to his people, to tell to the coming generation the testimony of their God. And as you recall the story of his faithfulness, to allow it to come from your heart and not solely your mind. Brian shared this last week in Psalm 77, that recalling the faithfulness of God is like a balm for our soul. When Asaph wrote this, this is true. This is what he meant, that in these seasons of lament, remembering the faithfulness of God is like a balm for our soul. But here in this next chapter, he says, but don't stop there. Don't stop simply at allowing it to be a balm for your soul, but allow it to flow from your lips. Allow it to flow into the next generation. Allow them to recognize this truth that he writes in these verses, that God is the only one worthy of our hope and our ultimate obedience. Here's the kicker. When I wrote that this week as I was preparing for this message, I kind of typed it here on my computer, and I even just like sat back for a second and I said, man, I think we got that. And then a gentle nudge of the Spirit even in that moment said, and that's kind of the point. That we hear a statement like that and we say, yeah, I got that. I know that. I know that to be true. But it's not simply knowledge intellectually. It's a truth that Asaph is pushing for us to take root into our hearts, to plant it deep within our soul, that it might flow here from our mouths. Because when I reflect on my week, I think, how quickly do I become like the people of God throughout my day-to-day? When Monday hits, when the first frustration comes, how quickly do I fall into the stubborn pitfalls of thinking I can do it? How quickly do I fall into the pitfall of being a rebellious person here, chasing my own way? How quickly do I begin to believe that if I just put my hope into this next accolade, this next achievement, if I can just stand here and hold real tight and white knuckle my way through this wall, I can get to a place where I can finally find peace and comfort. I just have to work a little harder. I just have to try a little more. And if I do that, then I can finally achieve this hope and this peace all on my own. And here, before he ever even tells the story, Asaph knows the tendency of our hearts to approach our days like this. Because he knows that when we begin to place our hope in those things, our rhythms inevitably follow. The way we live out our day, the way we obey, eventually follows that in which we place our hope. A few years ago, I had an opportunity to teach a senior Bible class just for a couple of months. It was just in a replacement of somebody who had left. And I asked them this question. It was a question that came to me in a conversation with a, man, it feels good, but the microphone makes noise. And so I'm just going to kind of do that. Okay. It was a question that came to me in a conversation with somebody. And it was something I wanted to ask them. I said, what spurs you on in the desert? And what I meant by it, when I opened it up for them, I said, I want you to imagine these valleys of your life. I want you to imagine these moments in which it feels barren, similar to how we read last week in Psalm 77, right? It feels like there's no hope. It feels like simply just taking the next step is going to take every ounce of energy that you don't even have anymore. What spurs you to take that next step? And I gave him a couple days to think through that, to write through that. And we came back together and I said, the reason I asked this question for you is because so often our answer to that question can give us a great indication of where we're finding our hope, of where we're finding our identity, where we're finding our worth, where we begin to believe that if I can just get here, then I will achieve whatever it is that we're living a life of obedience toward. And this is the foundation that Asaph jumps into the story here this morning. So we're going to jump into verse 9 here, and he's going to begin to tell the story of God's people, of their ancestors, of as they walked through God's faithfulness here. Starting in verse 9, the Ephraimites armed with the bow turned back on the day of battle. They did not keep God's covenant, but refused to walk according to his law. They forgot his works and the wonders that he had shown them. In the sight of their fathers, he performed wonders in the land of Egypt, in the fields of Zoan. He divided the sea and let them pass through it, and made the waters stand like a heap. In the daytime, he led them with a cloud, and all the night with a fiery light. He split rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink abundantly as from the deep. He made streams come out of the rock and caused waters to flow down like rivers. Here, I call this the flyover view of the story. This Asaph jumps into the story by sharing these mountain moments of God's faithfulness. And here he's doing so to remind them of the stories that they had heard, right? Do you remember when he led them out of Egypt? Do you remember when he parted the sea? Do you remember when he led them by a cloud of fire? And yet, he continues on in verse 17, he says, the people of God, yet they still sinned more against him, rebelling against the Most High in the desert. They tested God in their heart by demanding the food they craved. They spoke against God, saying, can God spread a table in the wilderness? He struck the rock so that water gushed out and streams overflowed. But can he also give bread or provide meat for his people? I love this indication of the people of God here, where he says they tested God in their heart by demanding the food they craved. Despite examples immediately in the rearview mirror of God's faithfulness here, they doubted God as provider. And I can find myself reading a passage like this and beginning to think, I don't understand. I don't understand how they couldn't see all that God had done and begin to doubt that he would provide for them the food they need. Didn't they see water came from a rock? And yet the gentle nudge of the Spirit, I think for us here today, is don't you see yourself in this story? The circumstances may be different. We may have found a way to word it more eloquently, but at the root of it all, we have placed our hope in something else. Our emotions that are tied to our circumstances have begun to bring our recollection, to bring our mind back to our frustrations, the circumstances surrounding us, and ultimately brought our hope somewhere else. And as we walk through this story of Asaph this morning, I want to pose for us a couple of questions. And the first one is this: do I allow my circumstances and my emotions to impede my recognition of God's faithfulness in my life? This is what Asaph's pushing against when he tells them this story, is that as we look at our circumstances, much like your ancestors had before you, as you look at those circumstances, do you see those for the mountain of frustration? Do you see them for the worry and the anxiety and the concern? Or do we remember the faithfulness of God? Do we look back and know that his faithfulness in our past is always his faithfulness continued here in our future? Isaiah chapter 46, verse 4, he writes, even to your old age, I am he. and even to gray hairs I will carry you. I have made and I will bear, even I will carry and will deliver you. Through every stage and season of our lives, our Creator promises to be with us. This is the promise that we have from the Lord, and yet the enemy still continues to push us toward doubt. We're going to jump through 23 to 31, but in here we see Asaph tell this story of God's faithfulness. Once again, we see a picture of him providing for them exactly which they have craved. He provided for them exactly what they wanted. We even see a picture of his justice here. And you think in this part of the story, okay, here's where we begin to see change. Here's where we begin to see a shift in the lives of the Israelites. And yet we read down in verse 32, in spite of all this, they still sinned. Despite his wonders, they did not believe. So he made their days vanish like a breath and their years in terror. When he killed them, they sought him. They repented and sought God earnestly. They remembered that God was their rock, the Most High God, their Redeemer. But they flattered him with their mouths. They lied to him with their tongues. Their heart was not steadfast toward him. They were not faithful to his covenant. If I'm being honest here, this was the gut punch of the story for me. As I was preparing this week, this is where I landed the longest, and this is where I'd like to sit here even for just a few minutes. Because when we recall the faithfulness of God in this story, when they look at the response of the Israelites, we see in spite of all this, they still sinned, and there were consequences to their sin. There were consequences to their actions. And we read the response of the Israelites that sounds really good. They sought God earnestly. They remembered that God was their rock and their Redeemer. They remembered what had happened when God was faithful. They remembered that he did in fact deliver them. But their heart was not truly steadfast toward him. And here Asaph is reminding us that it's not simply just the outside. It's not simply just that our actions look right. It's not simply just that our rhythms do the right thing to do the right thing. He's reminding us that God is after our heart. He's reminding us that God is after the foundation of our lives. When I think about foundation, I'm reminded of my freshman year of college. My grandpa, he called me as I was finishing my ninth grade year, and I was heading home for the summer. He said, Josh, I want to build a retaining wall and I want to build a deck. Those of you who know me in this room, I'm better with words than I am with wood. And yet he wanted to do it. He said he would pay me. It was a summer job and it was going to be a chance for me to get to spend a great deal of time with him. What you also don't know is that he's an engineer by trade. And while I might be organized, I am nowhere near as meticulous as this man is. And so we get started first thing in the summer. I start digging this hole. We're going down, down. We get to about 1.5, 2 feet. And he said, all right. I said, okay, where's the wood? Let's drop it. He said, go get me the level. Okay. So I went and grabbed the level. I put it down. He said, bubble's leaning a little bit to the left. So we're going to have to get a little bit of sand out of there. He said, go get the flat shovel. So I went in there and I'm just like, going straight across. I pour more salt on my French fries than I did grains of sand out of this hole. But wouldn't you know it, I put the level right back down in the ground. He said, it's leaning back toward the right again. This went on about 5 or 6 times. And you can imagine, 18-year-old Josh was like, it's good enough. It's real good. We're going to stick this wood on top of each other and you're not even going to be able to notice. But he knew something that I didn't. Of course you're going to be able to notice, because the foundation matters. That when the foundation is not right, the cracks begin to show, the holes begin to come, and the thing on the outside becomes much like what Jesus shared even in his ministry, right? You brood of vipers, you whitewashed tombs, so beautiful on the outside, and yet your heart is so far away. It's why when we read the words of David in Psalm chapter 19, verse 14, he says, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. It's not simply just the words of my mouth. It's not simply just the rhythms of my day. He wants it to be rooted in a pursuit of him. So here's our question here, our second one from the story of Asaph. Do the rhythms of my day flow from a faithful and steadfast heart in pursuit of my Savior? Is my day filled with just the rote routine? Is my day filled with just checking the box of what I feel like I have to do, as if our walk with Christ is some formula that A plus B equals all this hope that we're looking for? Or am I living a life where the rhythms of my day are rooted in a steadfast pursuit of my Savior? Because he is faithful. And we see that here in verse 38. We're about to get into the real specific part here. Asaph is about to run. We're going to go 38 all the way through 55. But listen to how he tells the story. He takes a shift here in the telling of the story where he gets much more specific. Here in verse 38, he says, "Yet he," meaning God, "being compassionate, atoned for their iniquity and did not destroy them. He restrained his anger often and did not stir up all his wrath. He remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passes and comes not again. How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. They tested God again and again and provoked the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power or the day when he redeemed them from the foe. When he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the fields of Zoan, he turned their rivers to blood so that they could not drink of their streams. He sent among them swarms of flies which devoured them and frogs which destroyed them. He gave their crops to the destroying locusts, the fruit of their labor to the locusts. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamores with frost. He gave over their cattle to the hail and their flocks to thunderbolts. He let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress, a company of destroying angels. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death, but he gave their lives over to the plague. He struck down every firstborn in Egypt, the first fruits of their strength in the tents of Ham. Then he led out his people like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. He led them in safety so that they were not afraid, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. And he brought them to his holy land, to the mountain which his right hand had won. He drove out nations before them. He apportioned them for a possession and settled the tribes of Israel in their tents. You can almost hear Asaph as he's telling this story, as he's speaking this to them, you can almost hear after each line, "Don't you remember? Don't you remember this part of the story?" He's moved from speaking generally about God being compassionate and God being faithful, God being deliverer. He isn't flying over big mountain moments anymore. He's saying, "Don't you remember the swarms of flies when he gave the cattle to hail, when he led his people to safety, when he opposed any nation that came against his people?" These moments happened in the past. Certainly they're memories, but they're not just words on a page. They're not just happenstance. They're not just friends living 20 yards away across a field of grass. This is a picture of the greatness of our God, because the truth of his faithfulness then is the truth of his faithfulness now, his power and his might on his display, his love for his people. His faithfulness does not change despite even the fact that our emotions do. So as we walk through this life, do we look for the faithfulness of God on display, not simply to just remember that he is truly faithful, but that it might take root in our hearts, that it might shape the stories that we tell? Our final question here from the story of Asaph: do the stories I tell of my life point to the power, protection, and faithful provision of God? Because here's the truth about how we live our life. We all tell stories. We're made for story. There's a great power in story. We're going to tell a story. The question is, do we tell stories with simple anecdotes, or do we take the time to recall the faithfulness of God, specifically here, the way he has come and provided and protected and delivered us from all walks of life, and allow that truth to shape the stories that we tell? Psalm chapter 105, verse 1 and 2, he says, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the peoples. sing to him, sing praises to him, tell of all his wondrous works. We read in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, a familiar verse to us. But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect. I share this verse here because I think this word prepared matters for us. I think it's an important word for us because here we're being pushed toward an intentionality to recognize the specific faithfulness of God in our life. We're being pushed to be prepared to not just recall it, but to be able to share it, to be able to speak it to those around us, to be able to recognize the circles in which God has placed us, even here in this room. You know, we talked in our class, I think it was the last group of classes in here, and Ed pushed this as he often does, and then I sat in it for weeks as I often do, right? How often do I simply answer my how's your week going with, oh, it was good? And how few times do I fail to do exactly what Daniel modeled up here for us this morning? Let me tell you how God was good. Recognizing that perhaps, like he said, there's some of us walking here in this room that didn't walk in from a week that was in fact that great. But we get the opportunity to be reminded that despite our circumstances, God remains faithful. So as we wrap up this morning, let's see how Asaph wraps up the story here, beginning in verse 56. We see the response of the Israelites right from the jump. Yet they tested and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, but turned away and acted treacherously like their fathers. They twisted like a deceitful bow, for they provoked him to anger with their high places. They moved him to jealousy with their idols. When God heard, he was full of wrath, and he utterly rejected Israel. He forsook his dwelling at Shiloh, the tent where he dwelt among mankind, and delivered his power to captivity, his glory to the hand of the foe. He gave his people over to the sword and vented his wrath on his heritage. Fire devoured their young men, and their young women had no marriage song. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation. This feels like the part of the story where we see in the movies, we see in the other stories like, oh, this has to be it. This has to be the moment where God has just given up. We even read it. The response is different. It feels like the moment where God is just going to say, I am done. But we know the rest of the story. Continuing on in verse 65. Then the Lord awoke as from sleep, like a strong man shouting because of wine, and he put his adversaries to rout. He put them to everlasting shame. He rejected the tent of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but he chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loves. He built his sanctuary like the high heavens, like the earth which he has founded forever. He chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the nursing ewes, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, Israel, his inheritance. With upright heart, he shepherded them and guided them with his skillful hand. He closes out this story of reminding them of a season of hopefulness. God chose the tribe of Judah, and more specifically, he chose David to be king over his people. And we read here at the end, and we recall the truth of this, that David did indeed lead God's people with an upright heart and a skillful hand. And as hopeful as the end of this passage, as the end of this story is, we know the rest of the story. This very David would write of the one to come in Psalm chapter 145, starting in verse 3. He says, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall commend your works to another and shall declare your mighty acts. On the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works, I will meditate. They shall speak of the might of your awesome deeds, and I will declare your greatness. They shall pour forth the fame of your abundant goodness and shall sing aloud of your righteousness. The Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. The Lord is good to all, and his mercy is over all that he has made. We know that it's through the line of this very David that another would come. one in whom we are able to place our eternal hope, the one by whom all will be made whole, who shepherds us today with the most upright of heart, who guides with the skilled hand that never falters, who came down here to earth as a baby and lived a life that knew no sin. And as we read last week in Romans 5, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Even amidst our own rebellion, even amidst the places where we see ourselves in the story of the Israelites, God remains faithful. He never leaves or forsakes his people. He has seen each and every one of us, you and I, the depths of our soul, and loves us without fail. He's made a way to bring us back in communion with our Creator, and that is a story that is forever worth telling. That's the story that Asaph is pushing here to the people of God. It's the one he's pushing for us here today. This is the story of eternal hope. So as the band comes up and begins to close us out, I want to invite us into a time of reflection here, perhaps on the questions that we walked through today, where we begin to look at where it might be that we're placing our hope, where it might be that we're living out in obedience in the rhythms of our day. But I want to echo even the words of Daniel here this morning, that perhaps there's some of us here in this room that simply just need to be reminded of the faithfulness of God. And so if that's you this morning, if you are looking for an opportunity to be encouraged, to be prayed over, we have prayer partners that'll be in the back. I invite you to join them there. Allow them to speak of the truth of who God is as they pray over you. And I ask, if you will, allow me to do the same as we close this morning. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much. God, what a special people that you have brought here, so uniquely gifted, so uniquely designed in your image, and it is by no accident that you have brought them here this morning. God, what a gift your faithfulness is to us. What a gift it is to sing of your wondrous works. God, I pray that the truth of your faithfulness would not simply live in our minds, but would take root in our hearts, would be a sword by which we would battle the seeds of doubt that the enemy tries to place within us, and that we might live a life that is rooted in our eternal hope that's found in Jesus.